Tonight's session is one that's certainly not easy or comfortable to work through, look at, and recognize. We all know to some dimension that Christianity was persecuted for 250 years. We're going to look at some of the detail tonight, and then one more thing I want to do in this first 300 years is to look at all the isms that attack Christianity. You know, Montanism, Marcion, Gnosticism. If you would look at Friday's paper, last Friday's paper, I think the lady's name is Lopez. She had an article on Gnosticism, and it was a good article. And she had taken it from MacArthur's writing and just edited a little bit. And so we you know, it was a good take on that. But okay, so tonight we're going to look at the attack on Christianity from outside. Politically, and then next week we'll look at some of the heresies of where they're trying to change the basic concept of Christianity, and then we'll move on. We'll spend probably more than one session on what's the pivot. The pivot point is 325. It's called the Edict. E-D-I-C-T, the Edict of Milan, M-I-L-A-N. And that's when that Constantine writes this thing and says that Christianity is to be, tolerated. And in fact, become the, and so we'll look at Constantine. We'll look at Nicaea. That's the place where he convened all these church leaders and said, let's get our heads together on what we mean when we say we're Christians. And see if we can't get some unanimity in the empire. Now, Rome was looking for a way that, like Alexander did, in terms of Greekizing the world, when he swept across the known world, and that is to give them the same culture, get them locked together in the same way. Okay. Now, There's a thing that occurs more strongly at times than others, and it's called the cult of imperial divinity. The cult of imperial divinity. And so, imperial means the ruler, the leader, that sort of thing. So it's the cult of considering that the emperor is divine. Now, you gotta kind of get some feel for this. You know, Rome in its heyday, you know, had the greatest landmass of any nation around. And so if you're the guy riding that ship, you know, you're supposed to feel pretty highly about yourself and the people. And so they went, of course, took that to the extreme of that the emperor is divine. It's God's presence among us. Now, this didn't happen after Christ. It happened even before Christ. You know, we have that kind of Roman concept of worshiping the emperor. Okay. Christianity becomes a threat to the imperial divinity. Because instead of Caesar is Lord, Jesus is Lord. Caesar is Lord because he had a political appointment. He either was appointed the emperor or he gained it by assassinating the guy in front of him. But at any rate, you know, Jesus is Lord by power of the resurrection. Now, in the time before Christ, when Rome took over. See, you have the Babylonian captivity, followed by the Persian taking over Babylon, and Persia lets Israel go back home, and then you have the Greeks ruling, and then you have the Romans rule. So Israel went through four powers that ruled over them, and Daniel speaks of the four kingdoms. And so it's Babylon, and then Persia, then Greeks, and then Rome. Rome took over in 60-something B.C. Over Jerusalem, that sort of thing. And, okay. Now, after Jesus ascended, there was an emperor by the name of Caligula. I don't have his name down on this sheet I have in front of you. Caligula, C-A-L-I-G-U-L-A, Caligula. He wanted to put a statue of himself in Jerusalem. Now, that was 41 A.D. And before he could get the statue built and transported to Jerusalem, he got assassinated. Well, there's no one charged and no one took credit, but as a result, there came down with the next guy that came along who said, the Jews in Jerusalem, even though they're under Roman authority, are going to be exempt from emperor worship. Okay, that's 41 A.D. Now, if the Jews hadn't revolted, they could have continued to have that protection. But in 66 A.D., okay, 41 A.D., Caligula was going to bring a statue of himself and set it up in Jerusalem and say, y'all going to worship him. He gets killed. And the guy following says, I'm going to give the Jews a reprieve on this emperor worship thing. If you're a Jew and you live in the nation of Israel, you don't have to burn the incense to the emperor. That's, you know, that's where we're going to be with that. But in 66, 25 years later, the Jews, the zealots, they're called, they're mentioned several times in the New Testament, they finally decided, you know, we're just going to overthrow this Roman power over us. Now, you can imagine, it's like the ant spitting in the elephant's face. I mean, Rome is a worldwide power, and Israel is about like they are now. They're a postage stamp. I mean, you know, 100 miles north, south, 40 miles east, west, that's it. And they're going to spit in Rome's face. So Rome had the garrison there in Jerusalem, Antonio's fortress. You may have heard that mentioned from time to time. It was there. You remember when Paul, they had the big turmoil going on in the temple whenever they wanted to. They said Paul had brought a Gentile into the temple. Well, it emptied the garrison, and they came down, and they had a fortress there in Jerusalem to make to control peace there. And the reason they kept a garrison there in Jerusalem was because the Jews are bad about revolt. You know, they're bad about fighting back. You know, in the period between the Babylon captivity and Jesus, it's about 400 years. Well, there's a lot of uproars and different things that occurred during that time. And sometime we'll look at that period of history as well. But anyhow, in 66, the Jewish zealots, and those are the people who believe, Jesus had a disciple that was a zealot. And they believe that we should overthrow the power of evil by the power of the sword. And so they were guerrilla warfare type people. They were the guys who would walk around in the marketplace and bump up to a political ruler of some type, and they'd stab him and just keep walking their way. And he falls down, and they don't know what's happened. They did that cloak and dagger thing really well. So in 66, they just mounted up the forces and attacked the Roman garrison there in Jerusalem. 4 years. From 66 and plus 4 brings us to 70, which is when the temple falls. So for 4 years, Rome played with a war with Israel. And finally, attacked and destroyed the temple in 70 AD. A bunch of the Jews retreated down around Jericho, down around the Dead Sea, to a place called Masada. And they had a fortress there. They had water reservoirs in there that they could live for months and years with, and food and that sort of thing. But anyhow, Masada is where a bunch of them went down there, probably close to 1,000. And so they laid siege to Masada for a long time period. And when it was inevitable that Rome was going to take Masada, all the people there took a pledge. I'd rather die than be a slave to Rome. And so 960 of them, what they did, they asked the trained soldiers who know how to, what they call, kill you painlessly, you know, not hit you in the head with a hammer, but, you know, stick the blade in you at the right place. Well, they would go through family to family and kill everybody. Or the head of the household would do his whole family. And it got down to, I think they said when the Romans actually came into Masada, there was a grandma and five kids left out of 960 of them. That the rest had committed suicide rather than be a slave to Rome. And so that's all building there. And in Christianity, for a while, was seen to simply be just a subset of Judaism. And so the Judaism revolt pretty well squelched and there 70 AD. Now, right prior to the 70 AD event, the emperor, if you look at your sheet, the emperor, and his name is Nero. You've heard of him. Now, let me give you a couple more pieces of information before I talk about Nero. In 70 AD, when the temple's destroyed, Masada, the last fortress, is taken down. The Jews that were remaining dispersed all the way around the Med, you know, such that when Paul started his missionary journeys around the Med, he would encounter Jewish synagogues in people, various pouches of Jews in various places. He would try to evangelize them first. And then all of a sudden, Rome did not fear Christianity because they'd already put the thumb down on Jews. And so, but Christianity begins to spread. The Jews are not spreading, but Christianity begins to multiply and multiply and multiply. All of a sudden, you've got this growing group of people, and they're getting spread out all through the Med, and how are we going to control them? How are we going to contain them? And they are conciliatory to this idea of the emperor worship. In fact, they have a rival king. And even as much as they say, our king is a king of a kingdom, but it's not a kingdom of this world. But still that doesn't work. Okay. Now, in 64, before the 70 AD destruction of Jerusalem, there was, you know, Rome burned, a great portion of it. And Nero said, that the Christians that were in Rome were the ones who started the fire. And so there was a great outcry, and a lot of people, you know, got into the furor of that. And under Nero, there was a persecution of Christians, but it was only at Rome. And Paul and Peter would have been two notable martyrs during that time. Very sadistic. Everybody always mentions he burned Christians alive. He put them up on stands. When he was torturing the Christians and saying, here are the people who burned Rome, he put on this great, it's kind of like a circus or a county fair or whatever in his gardens, and he would burn Christians alive to light the madness of what he was doing. Okay. Now, there is a man by the name of, I don't know how to pronounce his name, T-A-C-I-T-U-S, Tacitus or whatever, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but I've never heard it pronounced. But he writes of the event of the Christians being burned for the fire at Rome. Therefore, to check the rumor that the fire started with Nero instead of the Christians, those who were called Christians by the mob and hated for their moral enormities. And why would they say Christianity has moral enormities? Moral enormities mean bad stuff, right? They eat flesh, drink blood, they practice incest, they're all brothers and sisters. And they have love feasts, and who knows what goes on with that, and all of that sort of thing. They're atheists. They don't believe in the gods. So, you know, you have to get your mind wrapped around the way they viewed Christians. These Christians were substituted in his place as culprits by Nero and afflicted with the most punishments. They were put to death during the reign of Tiberius by the procurator Pontius Pilate. Although this movement was checked for a time, this superstition broke out again not only in Judea where the evil originated, but throughout the city of Rome. Therefore, those who confessed were first seized, then on their information a great multitude were convicted, not so much of the crime of setting Rome on fire as hatred of the human race. The victims who perished also suffered insults, for some were covered with skins of wild beasts and torn to pieces by dogs, while others were fixed to crosses to burn and burned to light the night when daylight had failed. Nero had offered his gardens for the spectacle and was given a circus show, mingling with the people in the dress of a driver speeding about in a chariot. Although they were criminals who deserved the most severe punishment, yet a feeling of pity arose since they were put to death not for the public good, but to satisfy the rage of an individual. Now, Rome is real big on the rule of law, except when it comes to maintaining peace. They had a concept called police power. If there was, you know, the rule of law of Rome was so strong that Paul used it as a way to get to Rome. What did he do? Accused of a crime, he had the right to do what? He could go all the way to Caesar for the hearing of his case. Now, you have a nation that has such a strong rule of law that a Roman citizen was protected. A Roman citizen could not be beaten, could not be scourged, you know, and he could appeal his case all the way to Caesar, to would be the likes of our Supreme Court, taking it all with the line. But Christianity did not have due process of law, due process of courts. They were guilty if accused. Rome had this rule of law, but they had this thing called police power. If anybody was suspected as a disturber of the peace, then the police could move in with no courts, no due process, and do whatever they wanted to do. And it's, you know, that concept is talked a lot about, even in our own country, that's in the making, that would supersede any rule of law in the land. Now, Domitian is the next ruler let me first of all introduce you to something here. If you go down the dates here, Nero about 64, Domitian 90 to 96, Trajan, 98 to 117, Hadrian. But Hadrian finishes in 138. The next one, Marcus Aurelius, there's about a 30-year gap there. And this particular next ruler was good to Christians, not a persecutor. So the emperors listed in this list, you don't have always sequential dates, because in between some of these might be a emperor who was tolerant of Christians. Now, okay, you remember one of the apostolic fathers, Clement of Rome, was killed under the Domitian persecution. John was exiled to Patmos. His persecution of Christians was sporadic, centered mostly in Rome and Asia Minor. That would be like places around Ephesus and Philadelphia and all Philippi and all those places up and around in there. And their crime was refusal to offer incense to the genius of the emperor. And you can add on that they were unwilling to pay the Capitoline, C-A-P-I-T-O-L-I-N-E, Capitoline Jupiter tax. When Jews were in Jerusalem, they paid a temple tax. And so Rome came up with a similar temple tax. And, of course, the Christians would not pay that. Then Trajan was the next one. Ignatius, one of the church fathers that we've talked about. Christians were to be executed when found, but not sought out. Now, let's see. I thought. Let me hang on just a second. Okay. Oh, here it is. I thought I had it for you. Pliny, who was a sub-ruler, P-L-I-N-Y, Pliny, he writes to Trajan, who's the emperor, and he's saying, you know, I'm supposed to deal with these Christians. How do I deal with them? And he wrote to Trajan for instruction. Here's what he writes. From every rank, age, and sex, Christians have been apprehended. Should they be equally punished, the old and the young, the weak and the strong, simply for being Christians? If they repented, cursed Christ, and sacrificed to the emperor, should they be acquitted? Should anonymous accusations be received? Should they be sought out? Now, when Paul was persecuting Christians as a Jew, not as a Roman, but as a Jew, he practiced the seeking out persecution. Go find them. And when he becomes a Christian and comes back, you know, they're afraid to let, you know, to welcome him in because this is just a trick. So Pliny's trying to figure out, you know, under Nero and Domitian both, there were persecution of these Christians. And now he's trying to figure out, how do I deal with this as a ruler? Should anonymous accusations be received? And without due process of law, somebody could come in anonymously and say, Bill's a Christian. He said, should I try to find out if that's true? Do I just take it as truth and follow? What do I do? Should they be sought out? Pliny had already put some to death for their obstinacy, tortured others to get confessions. His procedure has already restored the sacred imperial rites and caused the temple to be frequented again. But the large number of Christians involved in all this made him hesitate to proceed further. And in the answer that Trajan gave to him was this. They ought not to be sought out regarding Christians. You don't have to go on a military hunt for them. They ought not to be sought out. If they are brought before you and convicted, they ought to be punished, provided if anyone denies that he is a Christian and proves this by worshiping our gods, he shall be pardoned as a result of his recantation, however much he may have been under suspicion in the past. No attention should be paid to anonymous charges. They constitute a bad precedent and are not worthy of our age. Now, over the next 100 years, persecution was handled this way. It wasn't a, we're going to race across the land and wipe this scourge off the face of the earth. But when Christians get in our way and they become known, we are going to punish them and deal with them. Now, Hadrian, in 117, he follows the policies of Trajan, and he punished some in that respect. There's another one that you don't have after Hadrian, Antonius Pius, and he protected Christians. One of the big things that always happened, every time there was a natural calamity, who got blamed for a natural calamity? The people not worshiping the right gods. They are offending the gods, and look, we've got a drought. They're offending the gods. Look, we got a monsoon. You know, we've got a volcano that erupts, and on it goes. Well, Antonius Pius was one of the first to step up and say, you know, they may not believe like us, and they may not do what we want them to do, but natural calamities are not attached to them in that respect. You know, so that gave him a little bit of reprieve. Polycarp, although Antonius Pius was favorable toward Christians, Polycarp was martyred during his reign. Okay. Now, then the next one here is Marcus Aurelius. He was a Stoic who opposed Christianity on philosophical grounds, and he went back to blaming Christians for natural disasters. So what one emperor gained, the other one took away. And let me read another section out of my book here, which gives the details of the kind of persecution that's going on. Now, not only were we excluded from public houses, baths, and market, but also forbidden every one of us to appear in any place whatsoever. Christians describing what's going on. Mobs subjected them to insults, blows, the stocks, imprisonments, plundering, the arena, fire in the iron chair. Now, fire in the iron chair, they had an iron chair, they said it, there'd be fire in it, and just set you down on it and cook you. Stonings. They were brought before the forum by the authorities. The accused Christians were publicly examined and subjected to torture. Some heathen servants, fearing torture, told the rulers that Christians were doing incestuous feasts and all these other kind of stuff. And so a new height of rage began to go. Even to the point of one bishop by the name of Pothinus, who was 90 and ill, was kicked and beaten before the governor and hurled into a dungeon where he died 2 days later. And then Belandia, a slave, a female, was mangled and broken and tortured, was finally gored by a bull. The corpse of martyrs choked the streets. Dogs feasted. After 6 days of exposure, the mutilated bodies were burned and the ashes dumped into the Rhone River. Why? They let the dogs, after they killed them, let the dogs eat on them, and then they scooped them up in a big pile and burned them all, and they took the ashes and dumped them in the river. Okay. It'd make the resurrection of Christians impossible. Okay. Does it make it impossible? Huh? Yeah, well, they mix out and they go out to sea. You're not going to be able to find them. You know, the resurrection doesn't depend on our DNA, you know, but at any rate, that's the extent of that level of persecution. Okay. Septimus, Severus, 202 to 211, conversion to Christianity was forbidden. But now, between, let me go ahead and give you this note, between Marcus Aurelius, 161, 180, the next guy that came on, ruled for about 12 years, 180 to 192, Commodus, he really shut down persecution for about 10 or 12 years. And then the next guy coming after him, it's kind of like reading the Book of Kings. One guy does right, and the next guy right after him does crazy. But then Septimus Severus went into a severe persecution. Now, what you got to appreciate is they're trying to, you know, a new guy comes on the throne, and emperor worship is the best way to secure your position. You know what I'm saying? You know, and you don't want any rival thoughts that the emperor is not God. You know, that kind of thing. And so they very severe persecution. Maximus, the next guy on the scene, Christian clergy was ordered to be executed. And then he killed a bunch of Christians because they had supported, the emperor's predecessor, whom he had assassinated. So, you know, I don't have that guy's name for you because, Severus was to 211. Maximus came on the scene 235. Now, because, again, that was a good emperor in between a couple of bad ones. Now, Decius, draw a circle around him, because it's like, if you go with Nero, go back up to the top of your page, Nero, Domitian, Trajan, Hadrian, in that section of history there, persecution was sporadic. It was just in particular locations, that sort of thing. And, that kind of thing, just like Trajan said, don't hunt them out, but if they're put in your face, deal with them. Totally, you know, different than some who followed. Now, Marcus, Aurelius, and then Septimus, we're getting back into a stronger push of persecution that's more widespread. When you get down to Decius, 249, 251, he's just on the scene for a couple of years, was the first empire-wide persecution. Okay? Empire-wide persecution. Now you gotta look at this. You would have thought that the worst persecution of Christians would have happened at the first. But we're 200 years out. And the worst persecution is now, I mean, here this Decius comes on the scene and, you can see what fueled it. An enthusiastic return to paganism. And they're not going to tolerate any rival God. And so he says, we need to exterminate this thing. And, let me read from Decius. Decius mounted the first systematic general persecution of Christians, vigorously proceeding against them as atheistic and seditious. Seditious, you know, the Jesus is Lord, atheistic, they don't follow our God. Following the celebration of the 1,000th anniversary of the founding of Rome, a belief prevailed that Rome's misfortune were due to the displeasure of the gods because of Christianity. The gods were being neglected. Decius ordered that everyone sacrificed to the god and the genius of the emperor. And he fixed a day that you do this or you'll be, your property confiscated, you'll be put in exile, tortured, or dead. And many nominal Christians complied and even got certificates saying they had complied. And this becomes an issue that we'll face in the church. These people got certificates of compliance with the emperor, and then once Decius is off the throne, they come back to the church and say, you know, I was just kidding, why should I die, you know, and does the church take them back? Can they get a hall pass when everybody else didn't take it? You know, that sort of thing. Origen died during one of that sort of, that persecution. Now, Okay. Valerian, Christian property was confiscated. Christians were prohibited right of assembly. And so he follows pretty heavily on Decius. And then you get down to Diocletian at 300. Now, I want you to think with me just a moment. 303 to 311. The Council of Nicaea will be 10 years later. I mean, 10 years before Constantine comes on the scene to legalize Christianity, the worst, Decius mounted the first empire-wide persecution. Decius had the worst persecution of them all. I mean, you're just a decade before Constantine. Now, it's a threat, and they're trying to get their power. This Jesus is Lord thing they won't tolerate. And you don't accept me as a god.
But was Christianity growing during this?
Oh yes, 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 they were growing. Okay, now after look at Valerian. His reign ends in 260. Well, from 260 to 303, you've got about 40 years, right? Alright. Between Valerian and Diocletian, Christianity prospered better than any time after Christ. Until the reign of Diocletian, after Valerian left the throne, Christians enjoyed about 40 something years of peace. They increased in numbers, they built places of worship, but their allegiance to one Lord still posed a threat to the imperial sovereignty. When Diocletian came on the scene, he decided the only thing to do is to exterminate them. And he would make Christians approach him on their knees. His persecution exceeded all others in brutality, intensity, and terror. It says that Christians could not hold public offices. They could not have civil rank. They either sacrificed to God or died, regardless of their rank, age, or gender. He would have them flogged, dragged, maimed. He would initiate lawsuits to take all their property. Whole families were executed together. He said the prisons bulged. Executioners became weary. Their swords dull from beheading people. Beasts, overly gorged on human flesh, turned away in the amphitheater. I'm going to kill these people. I've got all the meat I need. You know, I mean, that's how, and beginning with the burning of the church in Nicodemia, the persecution raged through the empire, except in Britain. And where Constantius, the father of Constantine, lived. And see, he's going to come on the scene. Now, the intensity and all that was there is just beyond thinking. And so when you think about the persecution of Christians, there were times when it was empire-wide. There were times when there was no persecution going on. There were times whenever Christians were persecuted but not sought. There were times when persecution was localized to Rome or to Asia Minor or somewhere like that. And but then there were times whenever people Decius, empire-wide persecution, Diocletian, who did the worst of them all, comes on the scene and really just 10 years before Constantine. Now, yes?
There were gaps in these dates. Can we assume that during those gaps they weren't persecuted?
Yes. They were. Those rulers were not known for their persecution of Christians. This is a sheet that I picked up out of Chad McCullough taught church history one time when we were over on Jackson Street, And this is one of his handouts. I just pulled it up. And so he only listed those who had unfavorable reaction toward Christians. So the gaps in between, you can, they're like between Hadrian and Marcus Aurelius, there's a man by the name of Antoninus Pius I mentioned a moment ago. He was more favorable to Christians, although Polycarp was killed during his rule. Now, persecution of Christians has never stopped. And because of the population of the earth now being so much more than it was during 300 AD, more Christians are dying today than died then. Simply because population numbers are just so much more, you know. I mean, population centers are just basically around the Med, and so it was a heavy percentage-wise persecution. Although today more people are dying than any other time in history, because people are getting killed in Egypt, getting killed in Syria, getting killed in Nigeria, getting killed in
Mosul.
Yeah, and only go. I mean, you can't find a country in the Middle East where Christians aren't being killed, in China, and on it goes. So when you get major land masses with major populations, there are lots of people that are dying. Now, one of the things that the church wrestles with is there's persecution in gaps. What do you do with people who didn't stand the test? And now they won't come back and say, but I'm part of you. How would you feel? How would you, you know, I may pick that up and I can, one guy, I was trying to remember his name. If I read down through here, maybe I'll pick it up. At any rate, persecution swept through the place where he was living, and so, He fled and ran away rather than stand the persecution. And he said that God hadn't given him the grace for martyrdom. And then later, he does die as a martyr. But it took him a while to get himself wrapped around that concept that he should not say Caesar is Lord and he should stand for the faith. Okay. That's a picture of what was going on in those 300 years. It is whenever Constantine comes on the scene and legalized Christianity, you know, you can just, you know, go, wow. But in less than 200 years, the church will be doing the persecution. He who was persecuted will become the persecutor. And I'm talking about to the point that in the Spanish Inquisition, 1.5 million people were killed by the church. And you just, I mean, I read this and I want to think, you know, it's like when I was in juvenile court and went to a seminar on child abuse and all that business. And the presenter was presenting, and he had written a book on his own abuse as a kid. And I'm talking to the point, put a noose on his neck and tighten it where he could breathe as long as he stood on his toes. But if he relaxed himself, it would choke him, and they'd beat him and all that kind of stuff, so he was going along. All of a sudden, he said, "I got married, I had three kids. So I mean, believe that I abused my children." And I said, "Not you, foremost." He said, "Yes, me." The statistic is that 87% of those who are abuse their children. It's amazing. I would never have dreamed or ever believed that would be true. I don't know what it is now, but that's what they were telling us in that. But what I'm saying is, when the church had spent 300 years under the sword, and then they mount the sword. It's just, it's a shame to the name of a Christian.